live.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Monday, everybody, and happy belated Mother's Day to all you mama melon heads out there. Today's May 11th, 2026, and our top story this morning, we got one for the gold bugs out there. Indian Prime Minister Modi has told Indians, don't buy gold. Well, good luck with that. You probably have better luck telling a zebra not to wear stripes. But yeah, Modi, he's saying, don't buy gold. Don't buy gold. Work from home and carpool. Got to save fuel. What the heck is going on in India? Why all these sudden steps? Well, India needs dollars. They are running short of Forex reserves. Why is India running short of Forex reserves? Because the price of oil denominated and traded in dollars has gone significantly higher. I mean, this is a preview of what is to come in pretty much any developing economy. We'll call India a developing economy. It's an emerging superpower, if you will. But they are highly dependent on oil imports, which means they are highly dependent on dollars to be able to pay for those imports. And when oil gets more expensive, well, problems start happening. And the Indian rupee, currently sitting at 95 to the dollar, has been in a multi-year decline. I mean, it started the year at 89 rupees to the dollar. Now we're at 95. A year ago, it was 84 to the dollar. And it looks like there's no end in sight there. So he's trying to say, hey, don't buy gold, folks. And coincidentally, in a totally unrelated story, gold imports in India have been stuck in customs since April 1st due to bureaucratic delays. Okay, I'm sure that has nothing to do with the fact that the government is telling people, don't buy it. We're trying to save our dollars. Slam the door shut at the port, slow everything down with the paperwork in order to stop the dollar bleed from the economy. Well, we'll see how that works. If you want to get Indians to buy gold, tell them not to buy gold and see what happens. Just throwing that out there. Now, meanwhile, why is all this going on? Why the story in India? Obviously, this is related to the closure in the Strait of Hormuz and the war in Iran. We had some developments over the weekend. And by developments, I just mean more of the same. President Trump said the Iran's response to our memorandum of understanding was totally unacceptable. Shocking turn of events. President Trump and the Ayatollah don't agree on a lot. So as that's going on here, we've got oils a little bit higher this morning, around $98 a barrel for WTI crude. Brent was around 104. We had ships were hit on both sides over the weekend. The U.S. Launched airstrikes on a couple of empty Iranian tankers trying to get into the strait. They're trying to deny the Iranians the opportunity to store more oil, trying to force them to shut in their wells, which is a big economic hit for the Iranians. At the same time, the Iranians are keeping up their side of the blockade, targeting ships off of Qatar, It was a Qatari ship was hit, and then they fired missiles at the UAE over the weekend, missiles and or drones. So the not war still going on there. Oil's a little bit higher here. Now, another story we got to keep an eye on. This could be a big one. Not yet, but it's coming. Shout out to our very own M&J, who sent me this one over the weekend. It looks like there could be a strike at Samsung imminent. Now, this is very important. Samsung's employees, they want higher wages. Apparently, Samsung, in particular, annual bonuses at Samsung are sharply lower than they are at rival firms that pay significantly better. Samsung has lost a lot of workers to these rival firms, and now the workers that they have managed to retain are threatening to strike. Now, labor laws in South Korea are much more lax than they are here in the States, so there's limitations on what the workers can do. But as it stands, their mediation has failed. They're in their last push to try to avoid the strike right now, which is scheduled to begin on May 21st. And would last for 18 days if it does happen. Now, let me just hypothetically ask you this. We're sitting here in the middle of a memory shortage, memory prices going vertical, memory stocks going vertical. What happens then if the largest producer of memory in the world shuts down for a little more than half a month? Is that going to help memory prices? Probably not. So it looks like more craziness in memory could be just around the corner here. Now, as that is going on, we've got Nintendo stock is dropping sharply this morning because Nintendo just raised the price of the Nintendo Switch Why did they raise the price? Because of memory prices. Well, the Samsung strike's not going to help with that. And also, I mean, the Nintendo Switch was not the most wildly popular console to begin with. They're also forecasting a sales decline because you may have heard the solution to higher prices is higher prices. So you got this memory shortage being caused by Sam Altman and his gaggle of dystopian effective altruists over in Silicon Valley driving memory prices vertical, causing possibly strikes at Samsung. Nintendo Switch sales are not selling. And then this comes on the heels. On Friday, we got the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey, another record low, 48.2 for the Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey. That is the lowest in history. But you know what? It's only been a thing for 75 years. So American consumers have not been more discouraged since the 1950s than they are right now. Take that data point and then look at what the freaking NASDAQ is doing and tell me everything is just fine. Tell me everything is great in the economy. Oh my, you know, when Locke's Ganapathy came on the channel earlier in January, we did an interview and she said the expansion of the K-shaped economy was one of her big themes for 2026. I was in agreement with her and, you know, yeah, that follows the data I was tracking at the time. But holy crap, guys. Look at what we're seeing. The spread between the two arms of the K is getting bigger and it is accelerating. And remember, as that gap gets bigger, as the top does better and the bottom does worse, there is a like a rubber band between those two, a tension that they exert on each other. And the further apart they get, the more powerful that tension becomes. Eventually, there's a snapback. Sooner or later, that happens. But for now, stocks just heading up and consumers just heading down. You got a comment from the CEO of Costco in their recent earnings call about the changing consumer habits among shoppers at Costco and the kind of meat that they're buying. Again, that one's going to have you shaking your head when I read you that. As all this is going on, we've got KKR and private credit is back in the news today. FSKKR is one of their publicly traded private credit funds. They posted a loss of $560 million in the first quarter. That's only about 10% of the net asset value of the fund. Okay, maybe we'll call it a rebuilding year. And in order to stop the bleeding in that fund and stop the stampede for the exits, KKR has proposed pumping $300 million into the fund to stop the bleeding. Even as that's going on in private credit, private equity is off in the junk debt market, piling up debt for dividend recapitalizations. If you don't know what a dividend recapitalization is, that is the mechanism of choice for private equity to strip mine companies for everything they're worth, leaving them saddled with debt and eventually bankrupt. They've done it to hospitals. Well, now they're doing it to these companies too. And last but not least, we've got an update on the First National Bank of Lindsay, Oklahoma, that tiny bank failure from October of 2024. That story I just couldn't put down. We have a big development in that story. Stick around for the end of the show for that one. But first, why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button and the subscribe button right next to it so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads because we do this every business day. And right now, the S&P 500 is down about 10 points here, 0.15% in the red this morning, probably higher oil prices driving that. The Dow is also down by 41 points or 0.08% lower. And the NASDAQ is lower by 46 points or 0.16%. So stocks are down, but not all that much. We've got the dollar is a little bit stronger this morning at 97.97. That is 7 basis points higher this morning. Looking over at the bond market, we've got yields are marginally higher as well. The 30-year yield is up almost 2 basis points at 4.966%. The 10 years at 4.386, higher by 2 points and change. The 2 years at 3.918%, higher by 2.5 basis points. And the 1 month is at 3.665, unchanged this morning. Looking over at commodities, we've got spot gold is a little bit weaker, possibly on that Indian headline, 46.92 for spot gold. Spot silver, meanwhile, having another good day, $82.78. Higher by $2.44 for silver, 3% in the green. I like the shiny. Copper, too, is up by 1.5%. Hey, look at copper. You know, Mish called this one out this morning when we were doing our briefing in the morning. Copper's very quietly risen to an all-time high here. Take your pick on what could be causing that. Is it tariffs? Is it data centers? Is it supply disruptions, higher oil prices, mines being shut down? All of the above. Copper has had a really good year here. Platinum is higher by 1.25%. Palladium higher by 1.3%. And crude oil is up by about 2.3%, currently $97.60 for June WTI futures. Let's take a look at Bitcoin. We're currently $81,187. That's off by about $1,000 from where we were yesterday, pretty much in line with where we were late last week. Bitcoin continues to hold above 80,000. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of these oil stories here. First of all, we got this one from Tracy Shuchart this morning on X. Crude oil in floating storage falls 33% in the past week. That's according to data from Vortexa. And then she's got this image shown on the screen showing the various regions and the percent declines that we're seeing in floating storage. The one thing I want to draw your attention to up at the top here, there's currently 103 million barrels of oil in floating storage around the world as of May 8th. Guys, that was 1.2 billion barrels before the war broke out. So you can see here, we've seen 1.1 billion barrels of oil supply cushion just evaporate in the, what are we, about 2.5 months since the conflict began here. You can see that we started this conflict with a supply glut, and that has somewhat cushioned the blow, even though we've still had higher oil prices. The dumping of reserves has helped. Of course, the jawboning constantly about peace, no peace, and you know the guy at Axios that's helping out with all that, that has helped to control oil prices. But the world continues to whistle past the graveyard when it comes to energy supplies here. And you can see it, more than a billion barrels in storage has just been bought up and is gone now since the start of this conflict. And that's what's leading to this story this morning. Modi says Iran war poses severe risks to India, urges cuts in fuel use and gold purchases. Good luck with that, Narendra. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi on Sunday urges citizens to curb fuel use, reduce overseas travel, and pause gold purchases, underscoring the severe impact of the Iran war on the economy. Global fuel costs have surged, Modi said in a public address in the southern city of, oh man, I'm going to mispronounce this, Hyderabad? Did I say that right? In the southern city of H, appealing to Indians to use public transport, work from home, and carpool to conserve fuel. India is the largest among the growing number of Asian countries encouraging lower fuel consumption as energy costs climb amid tensions in the Middle East. India imports nearly 85% of its fuel needs and relies on the Strait of Hormuz for about half of that amount, and 60% of its LNG and almost all of its liquefied petroleum gas supplies. Higher energy costs are expected to significantly widen the country's trade deficit and current account deficit. The rupee has also come under strain and is trading near an all-time low against the dollar. Modi said reducing foreign travel and gold imports would help conserve foreign currency reserves as higher oil prices increase pressure on India's import bill. And in totally unrelated news, standstill in India gold imports drags on and threatens supply. Apparently, this isn't really a suggestion that you not buy gold because they're not letting the gold into the country. Indian banks have been unable to import gold and silver for 5 weeks as unusually long halt that's pushing up domestic prices and threatening shortages in the world's second biggest bullion market. Shipments have been stuck at customs since the start of the financial year on April 1st and snared by administrative bottlenecks and a lack of clarity over taxes, traders with direct knowledge of the matter said. So what do you do when your currency's in free fall and you want people to stop buying gold? You just create red tape barriers and you don't let the stuff into the country. And you know, these problems just sort of solve themselves, apparently. By the way, the Indian rupee, what's really driving this, you can kind of see this chart. This is USD-INR, the number of rupees it takes to equal $1. And it just keeps going higher. This is going all the way back to September of 2024. In September of 2024, we were 83 rupees to the dollar. We're currently at 95. And just today, that's up by almost a full 1 rupee to the dollar. We were about 94 at the end of last week. And let's set this to, say, weekly candles and just zoom way back on the chart. And you can see that the rupee doesn't really do much other than go down versus the dollar. This chart just up and to the right for 50 years, but it has accelerated rather dramatically in the last couple of weeks. in particular because of the war. And this was kind of a surprising headline today. And I saw this one. I guess it makes sense, but I was still very surprised by it. Saudi Aramco first quarter profit jumps 26% as key pipeline reaches capacity amid the Iran war. Now, you'd think with the Strait of Hormuz being blockaded, Saudi Aramco would be posting a lousy quarter. But, man, that higher oil price, it is just pure profit for Aramco despite all the disruptions. Saudi Aramco reported a 26% year-on-year jump in first quarter profits on Sunday, beating analyst forecasts as a key pipeline, allowing it to circumvent the choked-off Strait of Hormuz reached full capacity. Adjusted net income stood at $33.6 billion in the first quarter, compared with $26.6 billion in the same period last year, the Saudi Arabian energy giant told CNBC in a statement. The Q1 figure was a 34% increase on the $25.1 billion profit in the previous quarter. Analysts had expected adjusted net income of 31.2. Our east-west pipeline, which reached its maximum capacity of 7 million barrels per day of oil, has proven itself to be a critical supply artery, helping to mitigate the impact of a global energy shock and providing relief to customers affected by shipping constraints in the Strait of Hormuz, Aramco CEO Amin Nasser said in a statement. So the Saudis probably not in any big hurry then to end the blockage of the Strait of Hormuz if their big oil company is making even more money from those higher prices. Meanwhile, keep an eye on this one, guys. And again, shout out to our very own M&J who sent this one. This is in the Korea Herald. It's not really global news yet, but I suspect it will be within the next week or two, assuming they don't reach some kind of deal. Samsung and the union make last push to avert the strike. This week's talks are seen as a last chance to avoid a May 21st walkout. Samsung Electronics and its labor union are making a final push for a deal this week as a planned May 21st strike threatens to disrupt operations at the world's largest memory chip maker. The two sides resume government-mediated post-mediation talks on Monday under the National Labor Relations Commission. As of 3 p.m., no breakthrough had been reached. So they're in the mediation after the mediation now, apparently. The negotiations are viewed as the last meaningful chance to avoid an 18-day walkout that could disrupt Samsung's semiconductor operations and ripple through the global chip supply chains. And guys, understand, you're already talking about a memory market that is completely screwed right now because of what Silicon Valley is doing and what the AI people are doing, gobbling up all the memory. Now we're looking at possibly the biggest, by far the biggest producer of memory in the world, shutting down because of a labor strike. Post-mediation is a follow-up procedure that happens after formal mediation ends if both labor and management agree to continue negotiations. Any agreement reached carries the same legal force as a collective bargaining deal. Samsung and the union failed to reach a compromise during mediation talks in February and March, prompting the Labor Commission to suspend the process. The two sides later agreed to return to negotiations after the Labor Ministry urged another round of talks. At the center of the dispute is Samsung's performance-based bonus system. The union is demanding that Samsung abolish the bonus cap and allocate 15% of operating profit to a performance bonus pool, based on projections that Samsung could post up to 300 trillion won or $204 billion in annual operating profit this year. Some chip division employees could receive nearly 600 million won each under the proposal. That's about $400,000 in an annual bonus, that 600 million won. So look, that might seem excessive, but that's what some of the rival firms are paying. It's a good time to be working in the chip business in Korea. Management has offered what it describes as a special compensation package that exceeds rival industry standards, but has rejected institutionalizing the removal of the bonus cap, arguing such a structure would be difficult to sustain. If this week's talks collapse, Samsung could face only the second strike in its history. The company experienced its first ever strike in 2024, led by the National Samsung Electronics Union, but at the time, the union had roughly 32,000 members. Only about 15% participated, limiting the impact on production. This time, the stakes are significantly higher. The broader union coalition now has around 73,000 members, with industry estimates suggesting 30 to 40,000 workers could join the strike. I've seen estimates a lot higher than that. The union has warned it will stage a full-scale walkout on May 21st until June 7th. Industry estimates suggest the 18-day strike could inflict losses worth tens of trillions of won. Now, Samsung stock right now up 6.3%. This is priced in Korean won. Don't ask me what that is in U.S. dollars. You can see year to date, Samsung is already up 138% over the last year. It's up 420% as memory chip prices have just gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Obviously, a strike, an 18-day strike, would take a big chunk out of that. But even worse, it would exacerbate the memory chip shortage, which is driving up the price of consumer electronics across the board. One such case would be this story. Nintendo plunges 8% after Switch 2 price hike and weak sales forecast. Nintendo shares plunged on Monday after the gaming giant warned sales of its flagship Switch 2 console would fall this fiscal year after hiking the price of the device due to rising memory costs. On Friday, Nintendo announced price hikes for its Switch 2 console in markets across the world as an unprecedented surge in the price of memory chips driven by the AI infrastructure boom has increased the cost of producing the device. Nintendo said that it forecasts 16.5 million unit sales of the Switch 2 in the current fiscal year, which ends March 2027, down from 19.86 million since its launch last June. The predicted fall in sales of the less than one-year-old console is raising concerns among investors. Now, it's also important to note Nintendo is notorious for excessively conservative guidance. So it's a good bet they're lowballing with that number and that the actual number will come in higher. But still, they are forecasting a significant decline here. And the price of the Switch 2 was raised by $50 in the U.S. and by 10,000 Japanese yen or $64 in Japan. Nintendo stock getting clobbered on this news, down 11.3%. Trading at $10.45 for Nintendo. So really bad day for this one. Higher prices, consumers rejecting it. They're buying fewer consoles. The Switch, I don't think, was all that popular to begin with. Higher prices certainly not going to help. And all stories like this are contributing to this decline in Michigan consumer sentiment. The University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index dropped to a record low of 48.2 in early May of 2026. Again, you're talking almost 75 years of history. This is the lowest ever. Missing market expectations for 49.5 and below the prior record low from April of 49.8. The current conditions component declined 9% to 47.8, driven by growing concerns over high prices affecting personal finances and buying conditions for major purchases. Red, gas prices, inflation, it's killing people. Meanwhile, the expectations index edged up to 48.5, though real income expectations continued their decline from March. About one-third of consumers spontaneously cited gasoline prices, and roughly 30% mentioned tariffs, underscoring that consumers still feel pressured by rising costs, particularly at the pump. Also noteworthy, year-ahead inflation expectations actually eased slightly. Don't ask me how to explain that, to 4.5%, down from 4.7%. While long-run inflation expectations dipped to 3.4 from 3.5. Possibly some of that jawboning about the end of the conflict being near has affected inflation expectations. I'm just trying to explain a number that doesn't make a lot of sense to me here. But you can see overall consumer sentiment continues to decline. 48.2, lowest ever, down from 49.8, which was previously the lowest ever. Consumers are not doing well. You can see it in this story from Costco. This is a quote from their CEO, Richard Galanti, during their most recent earnings call. And by the way, not just in this current recession or concern for recession. Historically, we've always seen some, like within fresh protein, we've always seen when there's a recession, whether it was 99, 2000, or 09, 08, or 2010, we would see some sales penetration shift from beef to poultry and pork. All right, buying less steak, buying more chicken. We have seen some of that now. I think anecdotally, I heard a few months ago from our head of food and sundries buyer that we saw some switch even to some canned products like canned chicken and canned tuna and things like that. All right, so people having tuna fish instead of freaking steak, you know, what stage are we there in the not recession? You know, contrast a statement like this, people buying canned chicken and canned tuna instead of steak, and then go switch on CNBC or Bloomberg and listen to these Kathy Wood muckety mucks talking about how awesome the economy is because tech, because AI. Again, there's got to be a snapback. These two completely devious or deviating stories have got to come back into alignment one way or another. Either the bottom 90% are somehow going to magically rise, or everything going on at the top, that euphoria is going to break and they have a rude awakening coming their way. Kind of like KKR just got a rude awakening. KKR's private credit fund takes a $560 million loss. KKR, the largest private credit fund held by individual investors, took a $560 million loss in the first quarter when a growing number of loans tipped into default. The write-down, equivalent to about 10% of the fund's net asset value, is one of the biggest indicators so far of underlying problems in a large private credit fund. Defaults in the fund jumped to 8.1% in the first quarter, up from 5.5% in December, KKR said. The biggest of those is that loan to software maker Medallia. Earlier, we found out that the private equity firms that own the company are not going to pump more capital into it, which means those loans are probably going to go bad. They'll be taken over by the lender. The $12.3 billion fund, a business development company called FSKKR, has been under pressure since last year when it disclosed its largest investment was underwater. That's Medallia. The stock tumbled further this year when big loans to software maker Medallia and dental service company Affordable Care went into default. The fund stock has almost halved in value over the past year, and the loan losses are starting to affect its ability to borrow money to make new loans, a crucial way private credit funds boost their performance. Two private credit rating firms downgraded FSKKR, their bonds, to junk status in recent months, and the fund was forced to renegotiate the terms of a large loan from JPMorgan Chase and other banks. To support the ailing fund, KKR will buy $150 million of new convertible preferred shares. It will also launch a tender offer to buy $150 million of shares at $11, slightly above Friday's closing price. And the fund itself will repurchase another $300 million of common stock in the open market. Now, keep in mind, this is the publicly traded fund. They can't just gate redemptions like a lot of the other non-traded private credit funds are doing. So they have to figure out a way to pump the stock here. And so they're doing these convertible securities. They're doing a big buyback, trying to get people to stop dumping the stock, because dumping the stock makes it harder for them to borrow money, which makes it harder for them to service their debt cost. And FSKKR has had a rough year, down 45.9% from a year ago. A lot of that coming just in the last few months. And keep in mind, guys, we're in the lull here between quarter ends. We will start to get those headlines in a couple of weeks here again about the redemption requests at the non-traded private credit funds rising again, more people wanting their money back, more people not getting it, right? We'll start to see that soon, probably in a few more weeks, and that will likely drag down these publicly traded private credit funds like FSKKR. And their crooked cousins over in private equity are up to something similar. Private equity taps junk market for dividends as exits stall. In other words, they're strip mining these companies. They're just looting them for all the money they could possibly borrow. And then when that debt goes bad, they'll walk away. Private equity firms are once again tapping the European junk debt market to pay themselves dividends as market volatility fueled by the Iran war and AI anxiety limits their ability to cash out. Brookfield-backed REIT BFIMO, Lutech, and Cooper Consumer Health, which is owned by a consortium of firms, including CVC, are among a number of junk-rated borrowers that have recently issued so-called dividend recapitalizations. Oh, that sounds nice. Dividend recapitalization. It almost has a positive connotation to it, with more expected in the near future, according to people familiar with the matter. Typically, the sign of a frothy market, dividend recaps offer a way for private equity firms to monetize their assets when a sale or IPO looks challenging. In other words, when the company's not worth what you advertise it as, you just borrow a bunch of money, put all that debt onto the company, and take the money for yourself in the form of a dividend. But in doing so, they layer yet more debt onto their portfolio companies, many of which are already highly levered. The fact that such deals don't boost earnings means that they are generally seen as a negative by credit ratings agencies because they raise interest expense and leverage. This is a top-of-the-market behavior showing up in a market that isn't hot, which is a red flag, said Sabrina Fox, a leverage finance expert and founder of Fox Legal Training. Sponsors are pulling out dividends because the docs let them, and the leverage going back onto these businesses comes at exactly the wrong point in the cycle. With M&A volumes below initial expectations for this year, sponsors are increasingly turning to dividend recaps as an alternative route to liquidity, said Hardin Servais, leveraged finance partner at law firm Simpson, Thatcher & Bartlett. Despite some concerns over leverage, many of the credit funds and collateralized loan obligations that originally invested in the borrowers appear happy to finance such deals due to the amount of dry powder they have at their disposal and their limited opportunities to deploy. All right, great. So private credit funds are still happy to buy this. CLOs are still happy to buy this because they're too busy chasing yield because they're desperate for yield. Oh, my God. This story is just terrible. And again, dividend recapitalization. Oh, it sounds great. It sounds complex. Oh, these are really complex structured markets and you wouldn't understand. No, they're strip mining these companies, looting them. The companies borrow a whole bunch of money. They say, oh, we're going to reinvest. They never reinvest. They just take the money, pay it out to themselves and their investors in the form of dividends. Now those companies are left with the debt and the service cost. Those companies are already in debt. It's a matter of time before they go bankrupt and then all their employees lose their jobs. Rinse, repeat. We see it all over the economy. And last one of the day, we have an update on the First National Bank of Lindsay. This one just on Friday. Former president and CEO of failed Oklahoma bank pleads guilty to fraud. Danny Seibel is going to jail. A former president and CEO of a failed Oklahoma bank has pleaded guilty to one count of bank fraud. There we go. All right. A win for the little guys, finally. Seibel pled guilty to one count of bank fraud. He was facing several counts of bank fraud and money laundering, by the way. He pled guilty to one count of bank fraud and is now facing up to 30 years in prison and a fine of up to $1 million. His sentencing date has not yet been set. And guys, if you're wondering, does he deserve every second of that 30-year prison sentence? Well, take a look at this video. I'll put a link down in the description to this one, the documentary I did on the First National Bank of Lindsay. And there's Danny Seibel right there, the bank CEO. This guy has left a trail of death and destruction throughout his life. Everybody around him, friends, family, coworkers, dying under mysterious circumstances. Well, now he's going to jail. And again, the corruption, the crime, everything, and the towns that have just been absolutely bled dry by this guy and the people surrounding him. It really was sad. And that story, man, I picked that one up in the fall of 2024. And, you know, a lot of people were very dismissive when this bank failed because they're like, oh, yeah, it's just another Silicon Valley bank, but it's really small. We don't care. And I went and looked. And when I started looking, I realized that a couple of days before this bank had failed, the bank vice president had committed unaliving self. I think if I say it, the algorithm flags me. But yeah, he ended his own life. And that was my first clue that something was majorly wrong at this bank. And then I go looking around in like the local Facebook group and I see all these Facebook Karens trying to silence any talk about what was going on in the bank. And right away, I was just getting Roadhouse vibes from this story from the beginning. And the more I looked, the more I realized that was the correct impression, that my gut was right about that. And yeah, believe it or not, that guy there, the Tiger King, this story touches him, believe it or not. I don't know. It's a stretch, but you can get there. Anyways, I'll put a link down in the description of that one. Check out that video. And until next time, guys, I just want to say thank you for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonheads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. Links also down below should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.